This is Tom. We're back on the Saturday afternoon show, and we are here at Wave Farm with sound artist Victoria Estock and Steve Lambert. Welcome back, everybody.
Thanks.
Hello.
All right, where are you going to take us now? We're just talking about highly directional sound speakers. Are we still talking about that, or where are we going?
No, we're gonna move more into work that, I mean, that Steve and I collaborate a lot on different projects, but this is one project that we had a lot of fun making together called Uncommon Ground.
I would say it's even more directional sound because the sound was transmitted through stethoscopes.
Yeah, uh-huh.
So the project was for, originally it was for Whitney Family Day.
Correct.
At the Whitney Museum. Yeah.
Did you have to be a doctor to listen?
We dress like doctors, yeah, though, which helps make the project seem more legitimate. And we seem more trustworthy.
People take you more seriously when you're dressed like a doctor?
It's shocking how seriously they take you. So we built this planter box that was about, it looked like it was a foot deep of dirt, but it was like an illusion. And so there were these plants in it, and if you held a stethoscope up to the planter box, you could hear the plants talking.
And these were real plants.
These are real plants, uh-huh, that we translated from, we took their root data,
yeah,
and then
sonified it.
Sonified it, ran it through this Google algorithm, and then there's a spoken voice where you can hear what the plants have to say, and only when holding up this stethoscope up to the planter box. And so this is sort of what they sound like.
Hey, kid. You think you know me? You think you know what I'm thinking about? You don't know anything about me, okay? You have no idea. Do you know what I'm supposed to be? I know. I have dreams. I know. I'm supposed to be a huge plant, a wild plant. I'm supposed to be 20 feet tall. So big I block out the sun. I'm supposed to grow tall and wide. Yeah. And put out huge fruit and feed the animals. That's what I'm supposed to be. But look at me. Look at me. I'm the size of your hand. It's ridiculous. Why? Because they don't want me to grow. That's why. They're keeping me. Why do you think I'm in this tiny little pot? Because they want to keep me small. My roots can't even get any bigger. I can't be what I was supposed to be. You got to help me get out of here, kid. You got to break me out of here. We could do this together. Yeah, yeah. Pick me up. Take me out of this place. Break the pot. Put me in the ground. Maybe in Central Park. Or maybe out in the country somewhere. I have to get out of here. I gotta get out of here. There's two kinds of plants in this world. There's house plants. And there's field plants, okay? House plants can never escape. They're domesticated, kid. You know what that means? They gotta wait for somebody else to feed them, water them, put them in the sun, cut them back. They keep them small. The field plants, the forest plants, they do whatever they want. I don't even get to be either one of those because what am I? I'm a museum plant. It's the worst of both worlds, kid. You gotta get me out of here. Wait, don't leave. No, don't leave. Can't you just, no? All right, I'll just sit here and wait for the next person. Someone will help me.
Was that a fern or a cactus?
I don't know if I remember, do you?
No, I don't recall.
Some of them were very specific, but the planter box was about 6 feet, 5 feet
five
square.
Five.
Yeah,
yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it was fairly big, and it. 8 different points you could kind of put a stethoscope up and hear 8 different tracks, you know, of like, or plants, 8 different plants, and different ones would chime in. Sometimes they would talk to each other.
Did they sound different at different times of day?
There was an hour, there was some like hour and a half total of plant talking. So you could be led to believe that, yes. It's very difficult to hear them all.
There's actually 4 hours.
Really? 4 total hours.
Yeah. We did a lot of that.
Yeah.
Interviewing.
Yeah.
Now, that plant seemed upset. Is yeah. it in general, are the plants mad?
No. Some of them, they're all, it takes all kinds. It takes all kinds. Some of them are kind of dumb. You have some queued up over there, right?
Yeah. Here's one.
I really don't understand why other plants are so boring. I mean, you're a plant. Grow fabulously, grow large, frizzy, have plants like flowers on plants, be a plant within itself, do things that you would never imagine as who you are, be something more, be an illusion of what you want people to think of you, make it clear that you are alive.
One thing that you never think about if you're not a flower is how unpleasant it is to have people sticking their nose on you all the time and sniffing and sniffing and sniffing. I mean, maybe I'm not at my best and I don't want to be smelled anyway.
Oh, now don't look at me like that. Don't even think about looking at me like that. No, I see that look in your eyes. Go find the restroom. Don't think about that. No, don't even think about it. Go find the restroom. Go on. Get out of here. Clean yourself.
Rubber plant. Never had it, always did.
So, some of those were, two of those that you heard were voiced by Reggie Watts, who luckily we caught him before he became incredibly famous. So they were all different kinds of plants, and the kids were like very skeptical that these plants were actually talking to them, but also
They totally believed it.
Some of them would try to talk back to the plants, and they're like, "Are you even listening to me?" Like, cause the plants weren't really great at responding.
They're more monologous.
Yeah. They have a lot to say because not a lot of whole a lot of people listen.
They have a lot of wisdom.
Yeah, yeah. So the idea.
They're kind of Buddha-like. They just kind of sit there and think about things.
They exist. Yeah, they exist. They know well how to exist. And breathe.
Some of them rock out a little bit.
Yeah.
Now, were the Venus flytrap, was it an angrier? Or was it?
I don't remember if we had...
Did you have carnivores, or was it just vegetarian?
I thought we did, but Victoria says we didn't. When did we do this? 3 years ago?
Yeah.
Both done a lot of drugs since then.
and no underwater plants. You were... Discriminating against the underwater plants.
Yeah. It was all stuff that could fit in a 5x5 planter. They were designed to sort of make these kids a little bit more empathetic towards the plants because they were adopting a plant later on in the day. Yeah. So we wanted them to sort of believe that the plant was like a friend of theirs, which I think that worked. There were kids that were like super excited too and just freaking out that the plants could talk and stuff.
And adults too.
Yeah.
And they believed us. We were in lab coats.
Yeah, we were in lab coats handing out these stethoscopes, and they'd say, like, how does this work? And we'd be like, well, you know, and talk about sonifying plant data. And
that we were research residents.
At iBeam, and that there were high, powerful electromagnets, and, like, you just throw out stuff, and they're like, okay, you know. So
both of you have had... described projects here, and Steve, you're also known. We hinted at this, the New York Times thing before, that you helped work with some folks that put out a version of the New York Times in 2008 that declared that the Iraq and Afghanistan, that the administration had called off the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, a little early.
This was in a believable New York Times looking format and everything, and
yes.
It got a lot of attention. Do you both like to mess with people's perceptions? Is that am I saying it right, or give them false ideas? Is this a little Orson Welles in both of you?
Well, I don't know. Isn't that what art does? Messes with our perceptions and gives us false ideas. Maybe. That could be one definition, right?
What, do you learn more about reality by presenting a
altering
false reality?
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, I've like been a big fan. I don't know if this fits with the plant thing, but like I'm always a big fan of presenting this contrasting reality so people can be like, well, this seems, why are things like this when they could be this other way, you know? The talking plant thing also is just fun, and I think like part of having fun making artwork for me is like keeps that muscle strong, you know. So later on when you really need it, like in the New York Times project where we're announcing the end of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and stuff, there's a really serious side to that, but if you have that fun and comedy muscle pretty strong, it makes that work easier, you know.
With that project, I wonder the impact that project. What do you think the impact that project had? Did it help? I mean, did it change anything in the world? Did it change anyone's perceptions? Did it alter the course of history in any way?
That is like the toughest question. And like my gut reaction is just no, it didn't really do anything, but I kind of know that it did. But that was the question that me and Andy from the Yes Men, that we were kind of steered the thing. That was what we wrestled with, you know, throughout. It was like, how do we make sure this actually does something? And then afterwards, like, did we do anything, and how do we make sure that we do? And sort of as a tangent out of that feeling, the Yes Men started the Yes Lab. That was like a logical sort of next step where they started working with nonprofits and people that needed that kind of work, and like, how can we help you as like a service? And I started doing more training activists with the Center for Artistic Activism. So that question led to some other things. But as far as how the newspaper did that, I know that journalism students were like talking about it. I know that Bill Moyers went to this conference and held it up at his keynote and said, like, you know, explained it and was like, this is what we need to be doing, figuring out ways of explaining policy in a way that's accessible and understandable, and he was a big fan of it.
It was kind of a major pop culture moment for a second there. You know,
yeah. I think there was also like a galvanizing of a spirit, because it was a week after Obama was elected the first time, and you know, there was like literally in New York that night partying in the street, and a week later to have a sort of like another hit come in was pretty nice.
And some of this things like add up. Like you go back to like billionaires for Bush and Gore.
Yeah.
You know, that led to 99% kind of. You can draw that line. One thing leads to another, and it does cause something to happen.
One of the goals of it too was to sort of change the tone of activism, and I think moving it away from this sort of like, no, we don't want this, stop doing this, don't do this anymore, which was how to me a lot of activism looked, was just like, we reject these things, and instead more the idea of a demonstration, right? This is the world that we want, this is what we want. It seems pretty reasonable, right? Like, how come we can't have this? And presenting the world instead of criticizing, you know, which the critical part needs to get done. But I don't know if it's always the best role for artists.
Well, sometimes it's better, the critical part is better when it's done in fun and jest than it is serious. I mean, how many people sit through a 20,000 word story in the Washington Post or something that's very important, or how many people see John Stewart synopsize it and get the point across?
Yeah, but I think also we need to sort of be presenting other realities, right? So like, kind of going back to what you were saying before about playing around with reality, it's like, in order for us to sort of be able to make a choice between what we have and what we want, we need to know what we want, and presenting that vividly in a way that people can experience and feel and like literally hold in their hands in the case of the newspaper is a pretty good way of helping people make that step.
And Victoria, you were trying to do the same thing with the children laughing. sound.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like sound, there's an immediacy to sound that breaks through a lot of other barriers that maybe visual art has, where people have to kind of approach it. And then there's always that separation, but sound can kind of break through a moment.
It's in your brain.
Yeah. You feel it.
Yeah.
So what other sound projects do you want to tell us about, or are you going to play?
I have some earlier stuff. I was kind of, I think, talking to somebody about this, about a big part of my work is interviewing people, or like allowing sort of people to respond to it, and that response is becomes part of it. And I think one of the ways that I got into that was through interviewing people for sound projects. So in 2006, I worked with Sarah Dierk and Michael Dodge on a project called the Anti-Advertising Agency Portable Sound Units. And so the Anti-Advertising Agency was a project that I did for, I think, 4 years or something, that was just about, like, the topic was always advertising in public space. And I worked with a lot of different artists, and we always worked on that topic, so it was focused for a while. And with this project, the first thing we did was interview people on the street about how they felt about advertising in public space. And so we would ask them sort of a starting question, and then depending on how they'd answer, we'd sort of argue the other side. So if they didn't like advertising, we would argue for it to get them to sort of explain. And then if they did like advertising, we would make arguments against it, and then make these recordings. The recordings were played back on these small wood boxes that we built with speakers in them and a hacked CD player, because MP3 players weren't cheap then, and a motion detector. So if somebody walked by under this thing where it was installed in public, it would play back these sounds. And the sounds kind of, they had to be able to be understood as people were walking by, and also kind of get their attention. So I can play you some of them. They're just...
And this sounds perfect for directional speakers, too.
Yeah, so I didn't know those existed then.
At that point.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, like, amazing later how easy it was to do what we did. Compared just a few years later, how easy it was to do what we did. But let's see. Hopefully this will play through here. I'm on that other
channel. Yeah, I've got you turned up now.
So this is what you would hear, like, as you're at the ATM under this box that you didn't notice.
And having advertising in schools.
I'm a teacher, so in a sense, yes, it does help out because we do have no money. But in another way, it's disastrous because these are students and they're so, you know, flexible. Right? I mean, they're just learning, so it can really appeal to them when they don't know what it's all about.
If I saw something that I wanted, I'd probably try to get it.
That a lot of parents don't even know it's happening, or they're going to be advertising in your school books.
If I didn't and I was just like a farm boy, I'd probably be like all overalls and just jeans. Since there is, I'd like all get nice things. I like kind of like the gangster look, so that's what I look for.
As a child, I was really conscious of advertisements, mainly because I was attracted to products.
The violence you see, even on advertisements, you know, all the games, they're all very violent. So everything seems to be getting a little more violent. The kids are more violent. There's more anger.
The colors and whatever was in there to attract me, I was like a big target, and I sucked it up.
And I was just like a farm boy. I'd probably be like all overalls and just jeans.
So they're very quick, and like, they don't go into a whole lot of depth, you know, but there was about, I think, 40 different clips like this, or about a minute long, that would get some of the ideas across and hopefully like get people to stop walking and listen just for a little bit, and then wonder what that was and talk about, like, well, they're talking about this and they mentioned these couple things, I think it's about this. Yeah, so I can play. I'll play you another one real quick.
You don't have any statistics like that statistic about the bananas increasing in sales. 130%.
Yeah, sales went down 30% in every store on that block. No, Well, I'll tell you another story in a second, but let me play you another one here.
Well, they say if you consider yourself smarter than an advertisement, then it's gotten into your subconscious.
So perhaps every advertisement's working on me. I mean, they intentionally are designed so you feel more intelligent in it, so you believe the message. You're like, oh, that's so ridiculous.
I like to think that I'm not as influenced by advertising as the advertisers would like me to be. I hope that's true. We'll see.
What if it's not?
Stay tuned. What if it's not? Then I have more work to do, right?
So those, like, tones at the beginning and the end are meant to get people's attention on the street. We tried to find sounds that you normally wouldn't hear on the streets just to, again, slow people down. And then if we could get them to stop for 60 seconds, they could hear some of this. And we hung out around some of them. We'd leave them up and drive around. And we had four that we built. So we'd hang up two of them, install a third, come back, get one of them, you know, like cycle around. And we had to change out the batteries and stuff. It was amazing how low tech everything was in 2006. But it seemed to work, and people would stop, and you'd see them sort of hanging out near it, which was really great to see. But all the interview stuff we published with a Creative Commons license, which allowed other people to do things with the sound. So and we put it online, and we put it on the Internet Archive, because we kind of, that research part of it was done, and we hoped that people would do more with the sound clips. And they got incorporated in some other, like a guy played them in between songs on some podcast that he was doing, which was great. And then, like, nothing really happened with them for 5 years. And I was like, all right, well, that was a good idea, but it didn't work. And 5 years later, I got an email from this guy who said, hey, I made a movie with your sound clips. And he animated all the voices with these characters and made a movie out of it. And I was like, and he was like excited because he didn't have to find sound for it, you know, or content. And like, we provided all the content, and we were excited because we got to see the project turn into something else. So it was
now you're hiding TVs in the neighborhoods for people to watch.
Yeah. Well, that video spread. The guy who made it was in Austria, so it spread around on its own, and like, the content kind of got a second life, which was great. But yeah, all that came from interviews. And a few years later, I did a public affairs show at KDVS, which is I was a grad student at UC Davis, which is the pepper spray school. When I was there, I decided to go back into radio. I'd done community radio in my hometown. And the public affairs shows when I was younger were like the most boring, horrible things. You know, like, I wanted to play music. I wanted nothing to do with like public affairs. And so when I went to KDVS, I was like, I'm going to try to make a cool public affairs show. It was this challenge that I gave myself. And so I had the show that was on from 8 till 9 in the morning. So I like to imagine that, like, people's alarms were going off to go to school, and then they would hear this kind of stuff. So let me kind of get it set up. But I would sort of pick a theme and then interview a bunch of people that I knew about it. And at the same time, I had a phone number that people could call, so I would tell them the week before, like, this is what I'm going to do the show on. If you have any stories about, say, shoplifting, just call and leave a message. And then, so it really was like this community show, because there was a lot of random people that just called and ended up being a part of it. But there was no announcer. Like, I wouldn't really speak, and I wouldn't say what the theme was. It just would start, so your alarm would go off, and it would just begin, and you'd have to figure out what the topic was, and then also what people were talking about, and who they were, right? So there were sometimes, like, I don't think I'm going to play this one, but I had a sheriff, a local sheriff on, and you didn't know her from anyone else. It was just another voice. And eventually, through the context of what she was saying, it became clear she was a police officer. But this one, I'll just play.
So it was try to make people listen closer, or force them to interact.
Yeah, and because you didn't know who was qualified to say what they were saying, you really had to kind of listen to what they were saying and decide if you agreed or not.
Instead of maybe preconceiving and pre-dismissing
yeah.
them.
Yeah.
Because they so were
like,
the sheriff.
If you told me I was listening to the sheriff on the radio, I'd be like, I don't really.
Half the people would probably be like one way, and half the people would be all like gung-ho, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But you'd have a sort of idea. And like, this was not your typical sheriff either, you know. And so it was kind of nice. The other thing too was like I would try to find this music that would go along with things and score it in a way. Because this show, the station had, you know, this great music library, so it was pairing things up, and then I had my own time limit of putting this together in about a week or two. So I'll play you a little part of it here.
Did you tell us what it was called? Did I miss
it? It was just called The Steve Lambert Show. I figured that way I could do whatever I wanted. So again, you're waking up at 8 in the morning.
Well, I think over time, you know, starting off doing loss prevention at 18 and seeing people that had done it for a while, I got to get a vibe, a feeling about the folks that did this work. And to a large extent, these were people that wanted to become police officers and other sort of authoritarian type figures. And I watched them, and I realized that I too had similar issues, and that a lot of times people are attracted to those kind of jobs because for some reason they need to get respect from people through their role, their position, as opposed to just by who they are and the kind of interpersonal relationships they've developed with people. So, you know, at 18, I definitely had a chip on my shoulder, and I just wanted to go out and kick ass, basically. And that's just not the way I wound up seeing myself later. After watching some of the people that I worked with, I realized, wow, some of these people are really off the deep end, and I don't want to be that way, and if I am, I need to change. And so I sort of developed a different attitude about the whole thing, but I still did the job. And I actually enjoyed the job a lot better because I felt like it could actually make a difference with people instead of just, you know, arresting them and hauling them off to jail. The way that you approach somebody, especially in loss prevention, is everything, you know, and you can create a situation from nothing or escalate it just by the way you interact with somebody when you approach them, when you stop them outside. If you come across as, you know, I'm Mr. Tough Guy Cop and I'm here to stop you, you know, people tend to freak out. I mean, who wants that? No, I don't want that. But if you come up to somebody and say, you know, hi, I need to talk to you about what you did in the store, you know, and you just, you just make it like a normal sort of thing, then you gauge where they're at. Then you can assess the situation a little bit better. Now, some people are just bad, you know, people, and they're going to, like, run, or they're going to try to assault you or whatever, but that's really not most people. Most people are going to be like, you know, okay, and sort of submissive and just go with you, but if you come off with a front, with an attitude, that's not going to be helpful at all. After arresting, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people in my time doing this, I started to see that it really took all kinds. I mean, you know, PhDs, Stanford professors, Hewlett-Packard executives, you know, down to like the high school student after school or the little old granny that has nothing else better to do. I mean, everybody comes to the ball game for different reasons. And and so you just started interacting with so many different types of people that you started to realize that anybody is capable of stealing And stealing has to do with so many different things. I mean, if you can figure out what it is, you can get to the heart of why they're doing it. And, I mean, a lot of people do it because it's just fun. Some people do it because they're bored and they have nothing else to do, you know, or they want to push the envelope. As teenagers, I found a lot of people would really steal in that age group because it's that time of your life when you're not quite a kid, but you're also not quite an adult, and you're challenging everything. You're pushing the boundaries. You want to see what you can get away with as an individual. And so sometimes that takes the form of, you know, what can you literally get away with? You know, how sneaky can you be? It's actually a good thing, I think, that people at that age are caught, because when you're dealing with somebody like an oil company executive that has a house in Bogota, Colombia, and just happens to be at Stanford for an executive retreat, who's also doing the same old that's the kind of person that they didn't get it when they were a kid. And so they have learned that doing bad things to other people without really caring about what the consequence is, as long as they're benefiting, is something that's been successful for them over and over and over again, probably because they didn't get that lesson a lot younger in life. Anybody's capable of doing it. It doesn't make
you
a bad person. It just makes
This was the theme of this one was shoplifting, and I had all these interviews with different people about shoplifting. Although, like I said, I would never state it. And actually, I forgot to mention, I rarely spoke on the show. So when I would interview people, like on the phone, I would take out my voice. If I did it in person, sometimes you might hear me, but I would often like try to, my presence in the show, even though it was called The Steve Lambert Show, is like incredibly minimal. So that, again, like, you know, you hit snooze and then you wake up and you hear this guy talking about arresting people coming into a store, and like kind of have to piece it together yourself, but also editing it down to try to make it as interesting as I could. So,
did you try to get facts across, like, or was it more of just people's stories?
It was a mix. What I would try to do is come up with either topics or impossible questions, and the impossible questions one is kind of gets to a more current piece, but I would ask them to tell me a story about when they got into a physical fight, the last time they got into a physical fight. And for some people it was a long time ago, you know, like as a kid, but telling the stories that lead up to that kind of thing. And then other ones, you know, one guy had a friend who or a friend of mine had a younger brother that I interviewed that just was like always getting into fights, and talking about the kind of trouble it had gotten him into, but you could hear him talk about, like, this, for him it was a very natural thing, you know, like, this stuff just keeps happening to me, and I just keep, you know, like, I don't want to fight, but people keep getting in my face, you know, and so it put you in, there were many different perspectives that none was ever presented as the right one, and, you know, you don't know who the people are, how old they are, anything like that, and you would just have to sort of decide what you think. And I really liked that kind of open-endedness for like a public affairs show. When you think about what a public affairs show is on radio, it's like, it's amazing how strict and standardized it is when you can really do anything. I mean, I guess there is certain legal stuff that you have to do to keep your FCC license or something, but
generally it's one person talking at a time.
Yeah,
and it is a very formatted genre.
Yeah. And you know, in my life, the kinds of the really enlightening kinds of conversation is not like it doesn't happen during a public affairs show. I don't have those moments. It's in those kinds of conversations where I was listening to that guy talk about why he got into loss prevention, what he learned from it. And most of the time, too, when you're forced to listen, either you're in a position where, I don't know, just what those kinds of like extended listening things, like people learn a lot. And the other thing, too, is that a lot of these voices were like local people. You know, every once in a while I would call out to someone that I knew lived far away that had a good story, but it was pretty regional, which was nice.
All right. What other projects are we going to talk about here today?
Well, I have more. Let's see. We have about 20 minutes or something.
A little less than, yeah. It's 5:42 right now.
Okay. I'll play another one of these. The Bad Jobs one. This beginning part's a little bit more produced. But it's a friend of mine, Scott, who is hilarious. And he was often a guest on the, there weren't really guests, but he was a voice on this show. And in this one, he's talking about how he's convinced himself that he has cancer. So I'll play that.
That sounds hilarious.
It is.
Listening to my lungs. They're whistling. They've always done this, but tonight the sound has me worried. And because of it, I can't sleep. I mostly just lay here and sweat, changing shirts every few hours. This is the way I've been for a couple weeks now. Worried. Over the years, an affinity for old motorbikes has led me to working on their failure-prone engines and brakes. Due to this, I have been exposed to a dangerously high concentration of asbestos, which is used to line the brakes. Recently, with the help of a computer, I happened upon the facts available about asbestos, and from these I have become very frightened about the long-term effects to my own health, most notably lung cancer. I've gone ahead and placed myself in the extremely high-risk category, called an oncologist who did not respond, and generally taken to this new dark fixation. Now, whenever my mind is not busy with other thoughts, it tends to slip back to thinking about this potential future tragedy, spinning off a few different scenarios of my own end and making me feel paralytically remorseful about whatever happens to be my present waste of precious time. Hogwash, you might be thinking. This morbid obsession is ridiculous for a young, healthy man. Well, maybe it is. But I haven't yet found a way to remove myself from this type of admittedly ugly thinking. And even if I could, I'm not sure how easily I'd let it go. See, I consider traits like this to be an asset. Of the people I know, the ones I am most fond of are those with the most distinct personal abnormalities. I don't mean drug addicts and bullies, I've seen that too many times already. Rather, I like people with terrible fears, social anxieties, delusional thinking, insecurities, depression, people with voices in their heads and impulses to kick dogs, kick children, lick it up off the ground, people who think other people are psychic and base their own fears on this. These are all very attractive to me. I see people with strong emotional instability, and in my mind I whisper, "I know you." And I have the feeling that some of them can hear me. Maybe this will all change. Maybe I won't find these things so amusing anymore. I won't relate to the same people the way I do now. But I don't think that'll happen very soon. Not tonight, anyway. Tonight I'm lying in my bed, counting my breath. Nostalgic already for each passing one.
All right, you're listening to the Saturday Afternoon Show. I'm Tom Rowe, and we're here with Victoria Estock and Steve Lambert. Steve, what was that again?
That was the beginning of a show about bad jobs. And so Scott had, you know, convinced himself from working on motorcycles and shaving the brakes that he had gotten the cancer, I forget, mesothelioma that you get from asbestos from the brake pads. And I just like the idea of, again, waking up at 8 in the morning, your alarm goes off, and he's talking about his insane inner thoughts, you know. But then it goes on to that, to like all these different kinds of terrible jobs that, that people had had and stories around that. So, but yeah, so the interviewing people thing has sort of come back around, and the impossible questions with this most recent piece that I made called Capitalism Works for Me, True False, and it's a 20-foot-wide, 9-foot-tall aluminum sign with a bunch of lights in it that says Capitalism Works for Me, and there's a scoreboard in it. So you can vote at a podium that's next to it, and if you hit the true button, the score on true goes up, and if you hit a false, it goes up. So at any time, you know, you might walk by and you can see what the score is, whether or not capitalism is working for people in that area. So there's the sign part of it, but there's also these interviews that I've been collecting with people, asking them why they voted the way that they voted. And actually Victoria's helped out with this, because it's a lot of times in these sort of public situations a real madhouse, like when we're doing this. So I'll be talking to one person and she's spotting another one and, you know, doing some of the sound stuff. But basically it's, again, very open-ended. I just ask them, why did you vote the way that you voted? And I might ask one other question after that, just to hear why they believe capitalism either works or isn't working for them. And sometimes the answers are really heartbreaking or just, you know, horrifying or really strange. And what I'm going to play next is a sort of set of interviews with people that we did in Boston. And this video, there's a video part of it too that you can see on my site. But I'll just play some audio from it. Did you want to say anything about this, Victoria?
No, I think you covered it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm not quite sure where this is going to come in, but we'll see, and I can explain who it is.
In the end, you get a better product when you have lots of competition.
So this woman, we asked if she worked, if it worked for her, and she said, "Oh, of course," and she seemed very confident. So I was happy to follow up on why.
Though, I'm sure that there are the people who would say differently, though. That's why more people have voted no.
All right, it's going to go into the next one now.
Okay, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Awesome. My name is Lewis Morris. So, I voted the way I voted because I find that the best in life is reserved for those who have the closest access to resources. Growing up where I grew up, we did not have access to said resources. So, I'm lucky to go to art school, period. You know, I'm lucky to know about the things that I know about just because I seek the resources outside of my neighborhood and outside of my city limits. But, you know, it's not reserved for those who are poor, not reserved for those who are of a different skin complexion. You know, I feel like it's just not working and it needs an overhaul. And I think everybody senses this, but such a system deeply embedded into our society that they don't know how to implement anything different.
Where did you grow up?
Providence. Just 45 minutes away from here. I grew up on like the not so nice side of Providence, so that south side where you get a lot of gang violence and poverty and all that, you know?
And is there anything else you want to add?
I'd be surprised if more than 20 more people vote yes on this thing. That's all I'm saying.
All right, we're back on the Saturday afternoon show.
We're not. No, that's fine. That's fine. I can play some more too. But yeah, so that was a guy outside of the Mass College of Art, which is a state art school. I think the only state art school. Is that right?
I think so.
Yeah. So, you know, people that want to be artists and designers and can't afford private school tuition end up there in and around Massachusetts. So, that was just one example. Maybe I'll play another one. Okay, sure. Here we go.
I voted yes because my dad graduated high school, and then he, like, my parents had kids very young, and so neither of them went to college, and my dad started his own business, and now he makes, like, six figures a year. So that's why I think it works for me, because it's like, if my dad can do that, it works for my family, personally. So, yeah, that's why I voted that way. I mean, I don't think it works for everyone, because personally, like, my parents are divorced. It works for my dad, but not as much for my mom, because she's an immigrant. So she, like, doesn't really have that much. But I can't say it doesn't work for me completely, because my dad is... Yeah, the way he is. Yeah.
Great.
Thank
you.
Okay. You want to do that one?
Sure.
Okay.
Voted the way you voted.
Well, I voted the way I did because I think that if there's a lot of positives about capitalism. I mean, it allows people to dream, to reach for that goal, whatever it may be. I don't know what your alternative is. Are you suggesting any alternative to capitalism? Something better? And what would that be?
Well, maybe, I don't know. Something better.
Something better.
Yeah, my idea is that this might not be the best we can do.
Yeah. I think I certainly agree with that point. I think we can do better. But I think that, again, there are a lot of opportunities that are presented in capitalism. And I think that sort of the, to paint with a broad brush, that folks who are poor or lower income are against capitalism is somewhat... somewhat insulting that those folks, just because they don't have money, don't believe in the capitalist system, or that they're the capitalist system is a negative in their lives. It works. That's why you get a lot of immigrants coming to the U.S. I'm a product of immigrant parents, and you know.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to add?
No, I really encourage you folks for doing what you're doing. I think you should be commended for it. Young people engaged. It's great to see. Good
All
luck.
Right.
All right, we're back on the Saturday Afternoon Show on WGXC 90.7 FM with Victoria Estock and Steve Lambert here in Wave Farm Study Center.
And yeah.
Hey.
Hello. You want to... what was the impact with that piece, do you think?
I think the main thing is those one-on-one conversations. Like, the image of the sign kind of travels around, and I think people like the idea of it. But I've had even good friends of mine that say, "Oh, I didn't really get it until I saw how people react to it." And you know, in the different ways that people justify how they voted the way that they voted, and they're really. I mean, I don't blame them. You get to pick true or false. There's like no shade of gray. And so they all want to explain why they chose that. But when it gets into that, like, that's when it gets super interesting. And yeah, so the main impact, I think, is in these conversations. My favorite kind of response, like, I have one of them a little later in this clip, but I call it the slow unraveling, where someone will answer true and then end at false. You know, like, so they'll start explaining how it works, and then as they're explaining it, they're like, actually, for me personally, that doesn't work. You know, did you have something? Okay.
It's kind of one of those issues where people, it's like just accepted in the culture that this is the way it is, and nobody even, and when you start critically thinking about it, then you look at it a different way.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's not really a space where we get to evaluate it and question it. It's just, this is the economic system we have here, the end, you know? So when you, and most people don't think about it, and especially about evaluating it for themselves. And there's often this, like, well, what else would we have? Like, all
there's
the other
no
options.
No sense of an alternative, yeah.
Yeah, there's no sense of an alternative, and all the alternatives from the past have failed, which, you know, you could argue, but say that was true. I mean, in a sense, there isn't something that is competitive, but the idea that we couldn't dream of anything else, is that's really disturbing. And that's kind of the core of what the piece is about, is like, how do we create a space where this conversation is okay and we can start to dream of new things and better ways. And I'd never really, like that woman that was like, what are you proposing? And I always just say something better. And everyone is like, oh, yeah, I would like something better. Sure. You know? So that to me is like very central in the piece, even though it's like the least visual, least tangible thing about it.
Sometimes artwork, the best part can be, I mean, art doesn't always have to be saleable and a commodity. And this particular project is not commodifiable at all, I guess.
I'd love to figure out a way. I'm not going to say it costs me a lot of money. Yeah. So far, no.
Cash in on questioning capitalism.
Yeah. Well, I did do, like, crowdfunded it. So I guess in a way it was commodifiable in that way. But it was great to get, like, so many people that were in support of this kind of thing existing. And it's touring around the country, so it's gone from Boston to... Those interviews are in Boston, but, like, Hartford, Connecticut, Santa Fe, New Mexico, L.A., it's in Cedar Rapids, Iowa right now. So I'm trying to get it to a lot of different places. And most places I go, there will be someone who approaches me and says, hey, I helped pay for this. And I'm like, thank you so much, you know. And they're just really excited to see that it exists.
Well, that's very cool. We're coming up at the very end of our show, so I just want to give you guys a chance to give out some contact information if anybody hears and wants to get in touch with you or wants to look up a project that they heard about today. You want to give out your websites?
Okay, I'll start. My name's Steve Lambert, and my site is visitsteve.com, like the words, I am going to visit Steve, so visitsteve.com. And that is the home base. You can see the videos and hear all the radio shows and stuff there.
And I have documentation of a lot of my projects up on victoriastock.com. Just my name.
How do you spell it?
VICTORIASTOK.com.